Hello, and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time, we explore some of the fascinating research being done at Brock University by faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the university community. On today's show, we talk to the creators of a new video game designed to teach students about mathematics in a fun and entertaining way. We learn about research being done at Brock designed to better understand the brain and how it works. And we address the aging of Niagara's population in advance of a webinar scheduled for next week. Inquisitive Minds is on the air. Earlier this month on the program, we told you about a Brock researcher hard at work developing the interactive video game designed to help grade 2 and 3 students learn how to spell. Now the mathematics department at Brock has come to the table with their own computer game developed by a team of researchers called eBrock Bugs Mathematics Computer Game. The online game seeks to teach users basic probability concepts in a personalized, interactive, animated, and fun way. One of the game's main goals is to enable players to develop their ability to think mathematically, either independently or with the aid of prompts. I had a chance to view the game myself at a special presentation at the university last week and found it to be very entertaining and educational at the same time. The eBrock Bugs online mathematics computer game was created by Laura Broly, along with Brock Associate Professor of Mathematics Chantel Buteau, and Eric Mueller, Professor Emeritus of Mathematics who created the board game Brock Bugs back in the 1980s. I asked Laura what prompted her to come up with the idea for the game in the first place.
A year ago, I decided I wanted to do an honors project, and so I went to Professor Buteau and I said, "Would you be willing to work with me?" And she's the one who introduced me to Professor Mueller's board game. And that's where the concept really came from originally, was his board game and the work that Professor Buteau had been doing in trying to put it into electronic form as a learning object. And then I came in with perhaps a new perspective and read Keith Devlin's book, and we decided, let's go for a video game.
This is a pretty ambitious project to come up with. What was the reaction when you first proposed the idea? Did anybody at some point say, "You're kidding me, really?"
Yeah, there were even some times with Professor Buteau where she was saying, "Laura, you're getting a little over the top. You need to focus first. Let's just do one district at a time." And then actually the first semester I spent all on the concept and the first district. We added 5 districts, 5 games, and 5 more bullies all in the second semester, 5 of them. So yeah, my parents, my mom told me a lot, "Man, you're maybe getting over your head a little here." But I was really excited by the project and really passionate about it. So I was willing to put in the work.
Now, your field of study must be mathematics, obviously.
Yes.
Okay. So is this, dare I say, the grand finale to your education, or is this sort of a launch pad to the next step?
I'm hoping it's a launch pad to the next step. It was my grand finale, let's say, to finish off my undergraduate degree in the Mathematics Integrated and Computers with Computers and Applications program at Brock. So it was the grand finale of my undergrad degree, and now I am now at the University of Montreal. So hopefully, and I'll be researching math education there, and the hope is that this is really a starting point to further work, hopefully with Professor Buteau and Professor Mueller.
So what is it you're doing at the University of Montreal?
I'm actually doing a master's of mathematics, but my research is heavily educational based.
Okay, so the obvious question is, where do you go once you finish all your mathematics studying? Are you going to become a professor, or are you going to apply it in a different form outside of a university setting? What's in the cards for you?
I keep asking myself that question.
Do you have an answer yet, though?
I'm the type of person at this moment, unfortunately, unsure exactly. I can't pinpoint exactly where I want to be, let's say, in 5 years. But I know what I'm passionate about, and I know that right now what I'm doing is opening up the option if I enjoy myself over the next 2 years, I could go on to a PhD. Being a professor and teaching at that level and doing research, it definitely interests me. But I'm also open to other opportunities. I would be open to even starting my own business one day, or I'm really open right now to, I'm hoping that I'm going to be led towards something.
So the proverbial light bulb may go off over your head at some point, and okay, there's your eureka moment. It comes to you and you go from there.
I'm hoping so.
For me personally, math was my sore point. It was my weak link. I never did well. At one point in high school, I had a fabulous math teacher who actually made it fun because he was joking, he was humorous, he didn't take life or studying too seriously. But he got the message across. He was probably the most effective teacher I had ever had in any subject, and it just so happened to be math, which I was not particularly good at. This would have been, I think, grade 11. I'm wondering, do you really need an aptitude to begin with in order to grasp the concept of mathematics?
I would say math can be learned in the sense that, yes, can be taught. There are diverse ways to teach it. But the first thing is math learning is about doing mathematics. And young kids do mathematics, whether some people might call it mathematics, identify it as a mathematics or not. This is another question. But already playing with cubes for a young child and trying to combine things and doing addition, it's not addition on paper as it is maybe in school, but it's already math happening, right? So yes, math can be learned and math can be taught as well. That goes together.
I think for me, it was a case of, for most of the time, it just appeared dry and boring. This game and the earlier board game, which we'll find out about in a little while, just seems to make it that much more fun. One of the things at the presentation we attended was the word define probability for me. For the benefit of those who may not really be into the mathematics, such as myself, what are we talking about here?
Probability is a means of quantifying things which are basically, we don't know how they will turn out. So if we try to quantify something like, is it going to rain tomorrow? We build up some information about what's happening today. We look at maps. We look at various other things. And based upon that information, we try and quantify and say, is it going to be 20% probable tomorrow? Is it going to be 60% probable tomorrow? And we know from experience that even though we have calculated a probability that it's going to rain tomorrow, let's say 60% probability, we know that it doesn't occur exactly that way, but it gives us a quantification, a means of measurement that people can understand and think about. In other words, will I have my outdoor party tomorrow if it's 80% probable that it's going to rain? I know I should rent a tent because it's very likely to rain. However, if it's 10%, I'm not going to spend the money to rent a tent. So it's that kind of quantification which is important in mathematics.
Okay. Now, the game itself, and probably we'll be addressing this question to Laura, how does the game work? You went through the demonstration up at Brock that I attended, but in a nutshell, how does the game work?
In a nutshell.
Well, you can take a big nutshell if
okay.
you want.
Okay. In a nutshell, the player of Ebrock Bugs has come to Bug City, and Bug City has been taken over by a band of bullies. There's six of them, and they have scattered across the six districts within the city and taken over each of these districts using their mathematical knowledge. They are intimidating the rest of the more simplistic bugs of the city and keeping control using their mathematical knowledge. So the player of Ebrock Bugs is coming to the rescue of the more simple bugs and works through each of these districts to try to defeat each bully at their own probabilistic game in a public place in front of everyone so that all of the simple bugs can see that mathematical knowledge should be shared and not used as a tool for domination as the bullies are using it. So on top of this, the player meets a series of different people throughout. They have their guide Bugsy, who helps them throughout the game. They meet Smarty Bug, who helps them with the theory behind each of the games if they so choose to use is her help. And then at the end, there's a surprise that they're maybe not expecting.
So Smarty Bug would be sort of like a coach, life coach, if you will.
Yeah, she's almost, we like to call her the teacher on demand. So she is there whenever you need her. You can go back, you can fast forward, you can skip to a different part. And she is just there to try to help you understand the mathematics.
How do we know Smarty Bug is a female, not a male?
Because I say she is.
And you created the game?
That's
so you
right.
Can say, okay, fair enough. So how did you come up with the concept of Bug City in the first place? What drove the concept from the beginning?
The basic concept came from the name of the game. Eric called the game Brock Bugs. So I thought, Bugs, let's run with it. I am a big fan of Disney. So I wanted to create something that was sort of cutesy, fun, would get through to people in a cartoonish way. And that's where the design came from. But the actual concept came from wanting to build a world. The whole idea of having a city and obviously villains, it's a main part to most games, but having the different districts and having really a world that people can go and feel that mathematics really makes sense in this world, in this game world.
Basically, the player takes on the persona of one of the characters and going into different districts.
Yeah.
Does the difficulty level increase as you go along the scale to each particular section of the game?
Yes, it's been designed so that the difficulty level increases and the player's engagement as well increases as one goes through it. So it is already pre-designed this way. It means that we have that order. It goes from District 1 to 6. But the player could decide to start at District 5. So we have that flexibility in the game. But in terms of the didactic embedded in the game, we have decided on this specific order 1 to 6. And specific order means, yes, the level of difficulty increases and the help from Smarty, if the player decides to go and listen to the help from Smarty, will as well be based on previous things that she will have said about previous districts. So there is the level of difficulty that increases, but as well as Smarty, when she helps understanding, make the transition from the game to the math and back to the game, what that means. She uses things that she had mentioned as well previously.
Is it too early to get a gauge on what the reaction is like in the classroom, or is it simply too new to know that yet?
We don't know about Ebrock Bugs yet, so we don't know about that specific game. And the game is as well of a different type of math video game from most of the games that are found right now, some of them free online, is that it is designed to develop mathematical thinking and not the mere development of base skills, practicing skills, drilling, I would say. And there are very few of these math video games right now on the web, so it is difficult to know exactly of the impact. However, there's been a recent study, 2010, about the impact on achievement and on motivation of school kids. That was middle school, and that was in the U.S., involving 193 students and 10 teachers. And it was about a similar type of game, what we call the epistemic game. And the result is the following. Yes, it showed impact on performance, that means on achievement on exams, so they noticed it. They observed it as well on motivation. And that study used a control group as well as what they call the treatment group, the ones that played the game. And that was done over 6 months. It's important to observe the impact of such games on students' learning. The study would need to be a bit of a longer term because the development of mathematical thinking, it doesn't happen just one day from the next one. This is more long-term impact. And so for that kind of study, it calls for a longer term longitudinal study, I would say.
So what grade level are we looking at the game being targeted at?
Right now for Ebrock Bugs, it's been designed for targeting grade 12 data management students. So that fits perfectly with the curriculum. Lots of the concepts involved fits directly for that age group and for that course. It can be used as well for first year university probability courses easily. It could be used even for younger kids. The game is set up so that it should be fun to play, and then one could even even learn mathematics with it. The overall is the idea. We hope that it's going to be fun enough to bring kids, even maybe parents, to play the game. And yes, maybe why not learn some mathematics at the same time.
Now, could other math concepts be used here? In other words, could the game be adjusted to another mathematical concept other than probability and what you're dealing with currently with the game?
My quick response would be no, and it's good like that, because to have that kind of epistemic game, that kind of game that would prompt the development of mathematical thinking, one of the design principles is that the math should naturally arise from the virtual world. It should make sense in the world. It should not be artificial. If we wanted to change the math, then it would need to be somehow artificial to the game. So what I mean, for example, if a game was, I'm walking in the street, there's a monster coming, and the monster has an equation written on the chest, and I have to give the answer quick before the monster eats me or something like that, then sure, just change the type of question. Could even be about geography. You can even change the discipline. Then yes, you can interchange it. In Ebrog Bugs, the fact that it's a probabilistic game that is involved for each of the bullies makes sense in the story. So the player can still win, even not knowing the mathematics. And it is really intrinsically connected to the storyline and how the whole thing makes sense. So I would say my answer is no to this.
Okay, now Eric, I'll need you to come in here because I wanted to ask about the board game that kind of got the ball rolling back in the 80s. You designed the original Brock Bugs board game back in the 80s, right?
That's right. I invented the game. I mean, lots of people play with dice and do various things with dice, but this particular Brock Bugs I found nowhere else. It basically was designed as a two-person game whereby there was a board and players rolled two dice, one white and one red. The reason to have them different colors was it was meant for younger students so that they differentiated the ways in which you get a 7, for example, by looking at the white dice and the red dice as being two different dice. So it was developed as an enrichment in the 80s. In the 1990s, it was then, originally it was on a plank. It was really a plank with numbers on it. There was a new design on cardboard so that it could be distributed to teachers and to students free for anybody who wanted it, and it in fact is in many, many schools right throughout Ontario because it's been distributed free since the mid-1990s.
This must, Laura, to you, be almost prehistoric looking at the board game compared to this new digital version of it.
Well, there's a big difference, but I wouldn't call it prehistoric. Sorry, Eric. I like that word. I like ancestor. I mean, it's a huge difference, just the interaction level, the fact that now, as Eric said, he developed even more games. There's more games, more variations, right? Whereas the board game started off with one game in District 1, and now there's a storyline, there's characters, there's animations. So you can't really compare the two. It's very, very different.
It's taking the potential of technology as well. In the board game from Eric, the board game was there. Then there was a document, a teacher document separate for teachers to have some guidelines to how to use it in class to impact student learning. In the computer game, it's all embedded and it's somehow interactive too. It's visual, it's dynamic, the math is there. So everything that was on paper, additional on the side for teacher about how to use it in the classroom, if it was used, for example, in the classroom, now is inside the game. And so the student player with the parent, for example, or even just a player by himself or by herself, can go through the game and get that mathematics learning, that support needed to make the transition from the game to the mathematics. And who knows, maybe a player needs it just at the beginning and then gets it and that's it. Then just goes and just figure out by himself or by herself about the mathematics that is involved later. So that part is really taking the potential of digital technology to move from a game that had great potential to something that now we can easily spread.
Now, how accessible to the general public is the game? Is there any restrictions on who can access the game, or is it open to anyone?
No restrictions at all. It's free online computer game. So anyone who has access to the internet has access to Ebrock Bugs.
So where do they go to find it?
If you go to www.brockyou.ca and in the search search eBrock bugs, it's one of the first links that comes as a result of the search.
And you've obviously done that yourself.
That's how I get there.
Clever. Research. I love research.
I have a bookmark.
So what's next for the eBugs research team here? Are there any other games up your collective sleeves? An encore performance, if you will?
Well, the next step for now is to bring it in the classroom. We hope teachers will look at it and will implement it in some kind in the classroom. And we're actually just about to start a collaboration with two different schools that will use it in their data management class. And we're going to do this kind of small empirical study, a class with eBrock bugs, a class without eBrock bugs, and trying to look at the difference in motivation, so in engagement, and as well for impact on achievement.
Chantel, Laura, and Eric, thank you all for coming in today. This is fascinating. I'm going to go home and actually learn how to play the game. I'm going to download it probably later on today, and we'll see how I do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Brock Associate Professor of Mathematics Chantel Buteau, Professor Emeritus of Mathematics Eric Mueller, and Laura Broly, who finished her undergraduate degree at Brock last year, majoring in mathematics, and is now doing her master's degree in math at the University of Montreal. You can find eBrock Bugs on the Brock University website. So how is your brain working these days? If you haven't a clue, other than the fact you sometimes wonder if even you have one, when you do something even you can't understand the reasoning behind, well, we're going to speak next to someone who does know more than a little about the human brain. Brock University researcher and professor of psychology, Sid Segalovitz, has been conducting several studies designed to better understand the brain and how it works. Some of the areas he's studying include problem gamblers, fetal alcohol syndrome, and children's mental health. This last study has Professor Segalovitz and his researchers partnering with Pathstone Mental Health, the region's mental health service for children. Specifically, they are working on a long-term project to study the brains of children with behavioral issues, and the project will look at the brains of these children over a period of several years. They hope this research will help improve treatments and understand what is happening to their brains as they get older. Professor Segalovitz joined us in our CFPU studios recently to discuss his research and some of what we know about the brain so far, and I asked him about the complexity and fragility of the human brain.
It's an interesting way of putting it. The brain is both fragile, as you put it, and clearly we have to be careful about how we treat it, and also highly adaptable, so that if there are minor, but a colloquial, and knocks and gets knocked around a bit, it can recover because it has many adaptive functions. However, clearly there's a fragile aspect, and there are some aspects of brain function, if when perturbed or damaged, are not going to so easily repair themselves. As far as complexity goes, there's no question. The more we learn, the more complex it gets. And the way I like to put it to my students is, if it were very simple, we probably wouldn't be the kind of higher organisms that would be studying it. We'd be crawling around on the ground like earthworms. It's complex because we're complex.
Do you think we'll ever know everything there is to know about the brain? Or is that just a pipe dream, essentially?
That's not only, we could think of it as a pipe dream, but you have to ask, what is it we need to know? So you could ask, for example, if you've got a vegetable garden, will I ever know everything there is to know about my vegetables? And you say, I don't need to know the biochemistry. I don't need to know all of the details. I need to know how to make them healthy and grow well. And so if we have more modest questions about the brain, we can answer some of those questions pretty straightforwardly. It all depends on how deep we want to get. Of course, there's always more to learn. And the wonderful thing about this particular time to be in neuroscience is that the technology has tremendously grown. So that when I started off a long time ago, back in the 1970s, to record brainwave patterns, for example, would involve machines that cost, at that time, a fortune. Tens of thousands of dollars or $100,000 to really measure them well. And then with microcomputers, prices came way down. And so now we're at the equivalent of 1/10th or 1/50th the cost, which has allowed us to set up fairly sophisticated labs all over the world. And there's great work being done in many places. And now all it takes is ingenuity and time.
Computer technology must have totally changed the way you do your research. And as you say, making it that much more accessible, and you could set up basically a studio almost anywhere to conduct the research that you're doing, as opposed to having a bank of computers dedicated to this in a room and, okay, you have to come to us to do your research. You can take the research almost anywhere then.
Exactly. The machines are now portable. When I started off, it was enough to have 8 channels of EEG being recorded. In fact, we only use 6 sensors on the scalp, and that was enough to move the field forward. We now routinely use 128. We can go to 256 if we need to, but for the kinds of questions we're asking, we're finding it's overkill. And so the 128 is enough, but and really covers the scalp very nicely, right even down the face a bit, so that we can try to image electrical activity coming from the underside of the brain as its signals are propagating down and out. And the machines are incredibly portable, so that we have one system that literally fits into one hand, and we've taken up to Penetang machine to do research with my colleague Jane Dawan, leading that project with criminal psychopaths who are incarcerated and are not, they can't come to us, to look at how their brains may be responding to information processing of an appropriate sort differently from those who are healthy.
Now, you were talking about all the different lines. This would tie into the EEG work that you're doing,
yes.
I presume. First of all, let's explain what the EEG
sure.
is for those who wouldn't be familiar with it.
Right. As everyone knows, the brain is made up of different kinds of cells, brain cells. The ones of particular interest are called neurons. They propagate signals from one to the next, and there's, by varying counts, up to about 100 billion of them in the cortex. This is the basis for thinking. This is the basis for mental function. Each neuron has somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 connections to other neurons. So when you asked originally, is it possible we'll know everything about the brain, just think of the numbers we're talking about here. 100 billion neurons with 10,000 connections each. There's no way we can model that. We could count them, and hopefully we don't have to. What we do know is that many groups of neurons work as a unit and generate an electrical signal in their propagation of these signals. They generate a signal that we can measure at the scalp by putting an electrode sensor on. It's like having a radar and picking up the electrical signal. The signals at the scalp fluctuate very, very quickly, which is why, as everyone knows, an EEG looks like a lot of randomly moving wavy lines back and forth. But there is, of course, organization in that, and that's the job we have, is to try to figure out how to use that organization to relate to the brain function, to thinking behaviors, and that's what I do.
So in other words, you're getting the information, and it's up to you to make some sense of it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So the signal comes in as a fluctuating positive and negative electrical fluctuation. Just as in the electrical current that we were all familiar with on a battery, there's a positive and a negative. That those are simply, by the way, descriptions of two types of signal. We could have called them something else. It doesn't mean positive in the sense of good and negative in the sense of bad. That's got nothing to do with it. So this signal fluctuates between positive and negative. What we have found is that there's a systematicity in that fluctuation. So when you're very in deep sleep, there is very slow wave fluctuation, and the fluctuation is over a much longer period of time than if you're awake and thinking actively, then there's very fast fluctuation. The fast fluctuation presumably relates to the cortex communicating with other areas of cortex and sending information back and forth in a way that doesn't happen, of course, when you're in deep sleep. If you're very relaxed, you get some kind of slow waves that are in between, called alpha waves, which many people have heard of. So the degree of fluctuation is an indicator of some aspects of cortical function. What we look at in the lab is something a little different. We present stimuli to the person, so a word may appear on the screen, or a person's face may appear on the screen, or a picture of an object may appear on the screen, or we may play a sound to the person. And this information, of course, goes into the appropriate sensory organs. So if it's visual, it goes in the eyes. That goes back into the brain, into gets registered in the visual cortex, and then also gets registered in other parts of the brain, and they start interacting with each other as you start to make sense of what you've seen. So if I put up a word, of course you have to decode the word, you have to read it, and that has implications for various areas of the brain. If it's not a word you understand, or if it's a non-word, it won't activate a semantic area because it doesn't have any meaning. If it has meaning, it will activate associated words. And the same thing with pictures, of course. So we can get some measure of the way the brain responds to the different kinds of stimuli. So what we did, for example, at Penetang machine, was present in a paradigm, both emotional faces in one paradigm and another paradigm, letters of the alphabet. We know that from previous work that we've done in the lab and others have done as well, is that if you have a very simple paradigm where you say, press the key with your left hand if you see an S on the screen and press with the right hand if you see an H, or vice versa, it really doesn't matter, we just set one up, and present S's and H's fairly quickly. In fact, we present them so that there's a S and H in the middle of the screen, that's there to respond to, and they are also surrounded by more letters, which are sometimes the same and sometimes different. If they're different, it's a little more confusing, so you have to concentrate a bit more. It's a very easy task to do. Everyone knows what an S and an H is, but if you present it fast enough, people, of course, make slips. They press the wrong key. They anticipate and think one hand gets going when they really meant to do the other one, and they have some kind of reaction that says, uh-oh, an error is coming. And we all know what that feels like. You know, when you drop the cup before it hits the floor, you can anticipate and you tighten up and you respond to that there's going to be a crash. So it's the same thing. I'm about to make a mistake, and that's called error detection. When you do that, there's a particular part of the brain that generates a fairly large signal. It's very easy to pick up. And this is in a portion close to the frontal lobe, interacts with the frontal lobe, and we think of as an important area that regulates attention because, of course, you've suddenly been warned. Something you didn't want is about to happen. Well, it turns out the psychopaths are just like healthy folks when they are looking at S's versus H's and making an error. That area lights up the same way and activates the same way.
So there's no big difference
on S's and H's.
Okay.
But when we present,
but on others,
when we present emotional faces, a face that expresses fear versus anger, and they have to distinguish those, that signal is practically the error coding signal is practically absent. It's as if emotional faces, emotion in other people, just doesn't register the same way. And of course, yes, these are psychopaths. I mean, they don't experience the empathic response that healthy folks do. And that gets them into trouble. This group got in trouble. They were all murderers. I mean, they certainly did not interact well. So we have ways of looking at how emotional information has implications about brain function, and that's one way we can measure that. So one of my PhD students is interested particularly in psychopathic traits. Now, what that means is that's not saying these people are psychopaths. What it means is there are some people who are higher in empathy than others. And we can look at that and relate that to some of this emotional face processing. We've done some work already on this in university students. There's just a full range. Just like some people are more generous than others, there's always a range. Some people are more empathic than others. And when we relate that factor to brainwave patterns, we see some systematic differences. Our goal in this relates to a really important aspect of clinical intervention that has yet to be found to work, which is to try to identify in adolescents who may have these tendencies when they start getting into trouble, being destructive. So lots of adolescents receive the diagnosis of conduct disorder or some disturbing behavior, and most of them mature out of that or become productive citizens afterwards. But some don't. Some really become more destructive. And the question is, can we identify early on? And so far, it's very hard. And we're hoping that over time, we'll be able to, hopefully one of the collaborations we'll have with Pathstone Mental Health is to be able to find some way of predicting who is going to be in need of more intervention. Intervention with adults with this low empathy problem does not seem to work very well. But we do have reason to think that it does work with children, because there are programs with very young children for whom this does work. And so now the question is, can we find an intervention with young adolescents to help them socialize more?
So in other words, give them the help earlier.
Exactly.
To gain the benefit of correcting whatever problems there are.
That's right.
I think a lot of people would have assumed that the environment in which you grow up in is a huge factor in personality traits, what you view as good and bad, for example. So is it possible to change that other than the environment in which you're growing up in?
To what it perhaps can be worded as, to what extent is there an environmental factor, and to what extent is there a non-changeable biological factor that will be very hard to alter? The general thinking is that for most traits, the earlier you intervene, the easier it is. That doesn't mean you can change all traits as much as you want. So there's some very famous work done at Harvard back in the 1970s and 80s following through on children who were very inhibited, shy, you might say, as infants. A stranger comes into the room, mother is there, stranger comes in, and they immediately, the inhibited shy ones, immediately react and don't want to interact with the stranger. And other children, as long as the mother's there, are happy to smile and interact and so forth. put a new toy into the crib, and some babies just look warily at it, and others welcome it and go to play right away. And if you follow these children through, the ones who are highly inhibited don't become outgoing, and those who are very welcoming of new novel experiences early on don't become highly inhibited later. So there is a lot of consistency. There's some change, but there's still a lot of consistency. And for many psychological traits, there's consistency. Some people suggest there's a genetic factor, and no doubt there's genetic factors in everything, but whether that's a controlling factor or not is up for debate. What we do know is that there's, as you put it, there's experiential factors, and there's that can allow for some change. All we can do when we have intervention programs to help children adapt better to their environment is give them experiences. That's the only tool we have, and so we're always searching for ones that are effective.
If you can perhaps change things in the early going with children, at the other end of the spectrum, does it become too difficult when you get much later in the aging process? Does it become at some point too late to make any significant change?
Yeah. That depends on what you mean by significant, because it's never too late to make changes. Think of it this way. What is a change in the brain? Or what is a change in behavior? It's a change in the mind, which means a change in the brain. What else is changing? It's the brain that underlies mental function. So there must be a change somewhere in the brain. Every time you learn something, a new person's name, make a new friend, learn to play a new game, you've made a change in the brain. So to say it's too late to change is completely wrong. There's always changes being made, as long as it's at all possible to learn. There are some serious neurological conditions that make this very difficult, but they are by far the exception. I mean, if you talk about somebody who's a global amnesic, they cannot learn anything new because the hardware required for setting down new patterns has been either destroyed or is dysfunctional. But that's extremely rare. That's not what we're talking about. So in terms of normal development and normal aging, of course you can change. But as we've heard so much in the public media over the last while, you use it or lose it. You know, you've got to practice. Learning is a skill. Adapting is a kind of skill in the sense that it uses certain brain circuits that the more you practice, the better you are at. So there's always the encouragement to challenge yourself with something new. Learning a second language is a huge challenge. It's very effective at keeping everything going. Learning a musical instrument, it's a challenge. It's very effective at keeping everything going. And in that way, we think we can keep sort of the adaptability function going. Let me talk a bit about what this mental health and this adaptability, because that's really what I'm focusing on in my research. Adaptability means, to me, the ability to keep your attention focused and your cognitive resources focused where they should be, given the challenge that you're being presented with. If you're asked a question, how much is 15 and 12, and you're doing the mental arithmetic, you have to stay focused on the question to answer it. If you get distracted, you won't be able to answer it. If you need to move into a new workplace or go to a new classroom with a new cohort, you've got to adapt your behavior. If somebody is very poor at adapting that behavior, if they can't seem to control what they do with information that comes in order to, in a positive way, produce a helpful output, helpful behavior change, then we say there's a problem. And I see many mental health problems as exactly that: inability to control your emotional focus, control your cognitive focus. What, after all, is an attention deficit problem? It's an inability to control your attention. And we think that there is a particular sort of circuit in the brain that is quite central to all of this maintenance of regulating your focus, regulating your attention, regulating your behavior. We refer to this function in general as self-regulation, and the ability to self-regulate is core to a positive mental health. Of course, at different ages, we have different expectations. We don't expect a two-year-old to self-regulate very well. That's why they have parents and they have caregivers. We expect the two-year-old to grow into a five- or six-year-old who is much better at it, which is why that's the age at which we expect them to function well at school. We expect that to improve and improve and improve, and we certainly hope that by late adolescence, early young adulthood, that self-regulatory function is so well developed that they're able to be functionally independent. This is our normal expectation. Well, what is the function in the brain? Well, I just mentioned earlier this particular circuit we're able to measure with brainwave patterns quite easily that involves a structure called the anterior cingulate cortex, or ACC for short, that the ACC is very important in this self-regulation. And we have found in quite a number of studies from our lab that it relates to different personality correlates that relate to self-regulation. So being impulsive or being sensation-seeking or being high on risk-taking shows a lesser response than being, for example, obsessive-compulsive versus being highly socialized, being very careful. That if you're cautious, you have a larger response. Now, I'm not making a value judgment as to which is the better way to be. Obviously, one can be overly compulsive. On the other hand, compulsiveness is good if you can be hurt, if you're not being careful. Obviously, it is not good to take dangerous risks too often. On the other hand, if you don't take any risks, you don't learn, you don't get challenged, you don't go out and achieve things. So everything here has a sliding scale as to what is appropriate for the context.
Inability to change is a problem in itself.
Absolutely. And my question as a scientist is very straightforward. Can I find a kind of signature in the brainwave pattern that allows me to tap into the neurophysiological basis, the brain basis, for this characteristic that I can then use to try to understand what is driving certain types of behavior versus others? And the reason that I'm looking for a brain function rather than just looking at behavior is that behavior is determined by so many factors. When we bring someone into the lab and we give them a task to do, it would be very straightforward if all that was going on in their minds was focusing on the task. But I'm not so naive as to think that. They also know that they have come into a lab, that someone is going to be looking at their behavior, that they may be worrying about how well they're doing. I'll give you an example that we ran into a number of years ago that was only amusing after we figured out how to get around it. There's another brainwave component that we look at that relates to ability to stay focused on a task that for many reasons we think should degrade in aging because that part of the brain that we know is not functioning as well in the elderly. And yet, when we had older volunteers from the community come in and do the task, their brainwave pattern showing this particular component was superior to that of 19-year-olds and 18-year-olds at the university. And we thought, how can this be? These young folks are able to multitask and do many things at once, whereas older folks don't do that. They know to avoid that. And then we realized that the task is boring. Once we made it more of a challenge, very simply, by saying, okay, we'll pay you a small amount of something like 5 cents or 10 cents for every correct response you get that is within 200 milliseconds, that is 1/5 of a second of the time you're supposed to respond. In other words, here's now a speed challenge and an accuracy challenge. They suddenly perked up and suddenly their brainwave pattern increased. So we know there are many factors influencing this, and that's why the studies have to be very carefully done to account for the many factors, and we're hoping to get past the overt behavior and into a neurophysiological basis for the behavior, hoping to now gain more information about its base, its capacity.
This is fascinating research, Professor Sagalowitz. I thank you very much for coming in this morning. There's so much more I want to talk about, so I think we're going to have you back at some point.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was psychology professor and researcher Sid Sagalowitz talking about the studies he's working on to better understand the brain and how it works. There is no denying the fact our population here in Niagara is aging, and there will come a time we have to face the reality more of us are older than younger in the area, and that means our mindset will have to change along with it. Next Thursday, November 7th, a free seminar webinar will be held entitled Through an Age-Friendly Lens, Planning for an Inclusive and Economically Vibrant Niagara, and you're invited to register in order to participate in the discussion. The presenters are Dominic Ventresca, Niagara Age-Friendly Network Council co-chair, and our next guest, Paula Gardner, assistant professor in the Brock University Department of Community Health Sciences and an affiliate scientist with Bridgepoint Collaboratory and Research and Innovation. Professor Gardner joined us in the studio this week to talk about living in an age-friendly environment and how we can advance that idea in the future. And I asked what aging stereotypes she's referring to.
Ageism sits in that category with sexism and racism. And we're really talking about the oppression of a certain group of people. And in this case, mostly actually we think of ageism as an oppression around older adults. But actually there's some work that talks about ageism in terms of youth too, which you can understand if you think about the stereotypes we also have about youth, perhaps being lazy or not hardworking, or as a university professor, sometimes we carry some ageist stereotypes about our students. So it goes across the continuum, but it's really about discrimination according to someone's age.
So how can we work to overcome those stereotypes at both ends of the spectrum?
It's a good question, Mike. And I think in my experience, one of the best ways to address ageism is to promote intergenerational spaces and intergenerational programming. And what I'm talking about there is making sure that we don't age segregate our populations. So making sure places are accessible for everybody, both physically as well as socially, so everyone feels welcome there. And as much as possible, we mix age categories and age groups. And we know this in our own experience. When we spend time with people that from different age groups, we learn to understand them a little bit better, and they learn to understand us a little bit better. And I think trying to address ageism like sexism or racism is really overwhelming, and we're talking about changing culture, and it can be just a really challenging thing to do. I think a first step is to make sure we spend a lot of time with each other.
Now, it's not something you can do overnight. It's like anything else. It takes education and a period of time for people to understand and come around to it. We've seen that with several other things over the years. So realistically, this is a start. What time frame are you working with? Or is there a time frame?
It's interesting. It's a good question. Sometimes I feel like we're moving ahead in terms of ageism and the fact addressing ageism because we're talking about it a little bit more and it's on the radar screen. And I think boomers, of course, are really pushing that. Huge population that is moving into old age is forcing us as a society to consider how we address different groups of people. And they're saying, I'm not old like my parents were old and their parents were old. So they're forcing that conversation. On the other hand, I feel like sometimes we're stepping backwards, and I've done some work with immigrant groups, for instance, and finding that culturally, certain groups that used to actually respect their older adults in a way that we don't here in the West, Asian cultures, for instance, I have some researchers working in Japan, it's really changing, and they feel like they're slipping backwards in terms of how they used to have a lot of respect and dignity for older adults, and that ageism seems to be now playing a stronger role in certain places. So I guess I'm an eternal optimist, so I feel like we're heading in the right direction and there's been lots of gains, but that there's a lot of work yet to be done.
Yeah, and so as a society, are we just not showing enough foresight when it comes to the future that we all inevitably face when it comes to ageism?
You know, we all think we're invincible, particularly when we're younger. And, you know, we don't talk enough in our culture about old age or and about death and dying. And so I do think we're psychically and psychologically unprepared for the conversations that we need to have to really address it. I think you're right. We still have a lot to do, and we are unprepared in a lot of ways.
I think a lot of us look at, for example, our parents. I was guilty of this as well. I think of my father. When he retired at 57, I was, of course, a much younger man, and I thought, boy, it's about time he retired. He seems rather old, you know. But I think now, as I'm closing in on that age myself, it doesn't seem that old. I guess the way I look at it is I never feel the age that I am when I put it in the perspective of my parents when they reach that age. And that might be a natural assumption on our part.
That's changed quite a bit, right? We used to die off in our 40s and 50s. So the increased life expectancy means that the heterogeneity of the older age group population is really diverse, more so than it used to be. So the 60 is the new 40 and, you know, 80 is the new 60, for example. And I spend a lot of time interviewing people in their 80s and 90s, and they talk to me about not feeling old and wondering how they got there, and that they don't want to, for instance, go into long-term care facilities because there's too many old people in there. Yeah, I can appreciate that. I think one of the things people struggle with is losing our identity when we get old. And who wants at 65 to give up an identity as an artist or a university professor or a radio announcer for this new identity called old? And yet that's what we ask people to do.
And the forced retirement, well, one-time forced retirement comes into play here because we all thought 65, okay, we have to retire. For a lot of us, for example, yourself and myself, if we're still healthy, happy, and working and enjoying what we're doing, there's no reason why we can't continue on into our 70s should we choose to. But, of course, that presents another problem, the other side of the coin. It doesn't free up a job for a younger person coming up through the ranks. It makes it a little more difficult for them.
Yes, and that's something I think that we need to face together as a society. We know that when people lose meaningful, engaged activity, for instance, work, that can be really hard on their health, both psychologically and physically. And so we have to be careful about kind of, quote, forcing or pushing people people out of meaningful activity. And I think, again, the intergenerational piece here, there's been many examples where older workers can become amazing mentors. They hold a lot of knowledge and skills that we don't want to lose. And so passing that on, I think that's a strategy. So having like mentors that are older, and also sort of phased in retirement is a model that I think works, as opposed to sort of cutting people off cold turkey.
As part of the problem, do you think we take for granted that we're always going to be healthy and mobile? We're just not thinking this is going to happen to us, whether we like it or not?
Yes, it seems to me that we do. Although, again, spending time with 80 and 90-year-olds, at some point it seems that most people seem to come to some consciousness about it. I'll give you an example. You know, interviewing these people, I'll often say to them, okay, well, I'll see you tomorrow for the next interview. And they'll say, well, if we're lucky, and they laugh. And partially they're being funny, but it is a truth for them, particularly in those older age groups, that there's this realization that every day you don't sort of know what's happening the next day. And as a gerontologist, I just really appreciate that. And it gives me such great perspective for myself. People say, you know, you spend a lot of time with older people. That must be depressing. Or, you know, how did you do that? And yet it's so inspiring to me, Mike. And it reminds me every day that you just don't know what's going to happen, and to live each day as if it's your last.
I know what you're saying. Back in the 60s, I worked part-time at a nursing home in East End, Toronto. So I got to see firsthand the aging population, how they were dealing with their lives in this, for many of them, new environment, and existing with new people that they hadn't known all their lives, and dealing with the recreational activities that were there to keep them active. By and large, they adapted really well, and they enjoyed it. Not everyone, mind you, but that's inevitable. That's society. That's going to happen anywhere. So you can adjust to it if you get the mindset right.
And if society is prepared, I think we have a long way to go in terms of what kinds of, for example, housing opportunities we provide to older adults. When I think about myself being in a long-term care facility or a nursing home, and I think about the activities like bingo, I'm not a bingo person. And I think there are different models for this, and that I think, again, boomers are going to help to push this. I heard about an instance, for example, a group of older adults who pooled their resources, sold whatever sort of properties that they had at one point, and bought a new place that was close to a university where they had a nursing program. And they built two apartment buildings. And so the four older adults shared the place, and then underneath they had free apartments for nursing students. And so in exchange for that, they offered them some nursing services. And it was just a really nice model for affordable housing for students and older adults getting some of their needs met. And so I'd like to see, and I think we'll see some movement in different ways of housing people when they get older.
That's a brilliant solution to the problem. I like that. Now, there are people, inevitably, who are going to want to remain in their own homes, and we see lots of cases of people who will reach the age of, for example, 100, and they're still on their own taking care of themselves. And lucky are those who are able to do that. It's not always the case. But how important is that to maintain your quality of life and your independence so that you're living on your own should you choose to?
So the concept of aging in place is huge right now, and I think most of us would like to stay, not just in our homes, but in our communities. And because that's where we have meaningful activity and meaningful social relationships, where we feel comfortable in that physical space and that physical environment and that social environment, and that's really important. The flip side of that is sometimes that concept and that idea is really romanticized, that sometimes people end up aging in place simply because they have no place to go and they can't afford to get out of the homes that they're in, and that's a really challenging situation too, and not always the ultimate. Where we're heading here, I think, hopefully, and this gets to the idea of age-friendly cities or age-friendly communities, is how can we as a society support people who want to age in place, to stay within their homes for as long as possible, within their communities as long as possible. And again, that plays into some of those, maybe it's in their own home, but maybe it's in another kind of assisted living or supportive environment, but still within the communities that support them. And what can we do to enable that to happen?
So what can we do to enable that to happen then? That's the obvious question.
Right. Well, there's a lot we can do, Mike, which is great. And it doesn't necessarily all come down to health and social services. That's one of the things that we can do. Make sure that people have access to healthcare when they need it. And ultimately, when we get into our older years, we are going to bump into the healthcare system at some point. So making sure that those services are available to people and support services are available to people. But there are other things So transportation, for instance. So we need to make sure that there's transportation available that's affordable and accessible so people can continue to get out and about in their communities and stay engaged in life. Housing options, we need to make sure that those are, again, affordable and accessible and make sense for the kind of people and populations that are going to be heading into and through old age. Respect and social inclusion. So again, making sure that as we get into our older years, we still feel like we are viable, productive, engaged, valued members of our community. These are all many of the things that we can do to make sure that environments are age-friendly. And I just want to emphasize the fact that we are talking about physical access, of course, our streets and our roadways and buildings, but we're really also talking about that social piece. We can put up stairs and ramps, but if people don't feel welcome as an older adult to be engaged in these places and these activities, then the physical accessibility only goes so far.
Yeah, you have to have the right mindset, and society has to accept the fact that everyone is going to age and we all deserve the same respect and dignity throughout our lives.
If we're lucky.
If we're lucky.
I always yes. ask my students when I teach aging courses, what's the alternative to growing old? And it's not so good.
So let's talk about the webinars coming up on the 7th of November. What are you going to be discussing?
Similar topics to this, actually. So a little bit about who I am and a little bit about how I got interested in aging and health. I'll talk about what is this age-friendly cities movement, where it started from with the World Health Organization, as well as some lessons learned over the last 5 or 6 years. I was working in New York City on the New York City Age-Friendly Project and also working in the city of Toronto with a seniors panel looking at making Toronto more age-friendly. So I'll bring some lessons learned, which I'll share during that webinar, and then I'll also take some questions. As a new person to this area, I'm very excited to see what's already been started in terms of age-friendly in the Niagara region and some really great initiatives and real support for this. And I look forward to learning more about this region and how I can help and work with community groups and older adults here to help to make this region more age-friendly.
So who is the webinar directed towards primarily?
It's open, it's public, and it's free. I know that. There are a number of community groups, people who are already part of Niagara Connect's age-friendly network. Individuals can sign in. They can get together with groups and log in over the internet. And so you can watch the webinar on your computer screen and listen on your telephone. It'll be a real mix. So some people who know something already a bit about what's going on in terms of aid friendly, but also if you don't, I think that there'll be lots to be learned from this or new information gained from this too.
So this is Thursday, November the 7th, 12 noon, I believe?
That's correct, 12
How
to
do
1.
People register for it?
You can go on to the Niagara Connects website, and there's a link there to register. As far as I know, there's already been 76 people registered, but it's open to as many people as possible. So I welcome the more the merrier.
Will there be any follow-up from the webinar, or perhaps gauge some of the reaction that's been discussed afterwards?
If people are interested, we'll be forwarding resources to them, and there's also an opportunity for them to join the growing network that's pushing this initiative and looking for people to come out in different sort of spaces and different ways to connect on this initiative. So yes, there will be follow-up for people who are interested, but if you want to just participate in this one seminar, then that was okay too.
Professor Gardner, thank you for coming in today and welcome to Niagara.
Thank you for the invitation, Mike.
That was Paula Gardner, assistant professor in the Department of Community Health and Sciences at Brock and affiliate scientist with Bridgepoint Collaboratory for Research and Innovation. You can also register for the webinar next Thursday by going to www.niagaraknowledgeexchange.com.